Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fode, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Denver metro area. Tonight's author on tour is Nancy Pelosi, who reads from and discusses her new book, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters, published by Doubleday. In the weeks to come, we have William Dewey, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a moment, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover this afternoon, everyone. It's a great afternoon ahead of what's going to be a great week to come as well. And we feel very honored this afternoon to be joined by two of the nation and our local city's star contributors. To our wonderful city and our wonderful nation. First of all, Nancy Pelosi was raised in a home that respected and expected that family members contribute as public servants, take an active role in their communities, and live the Catholic faith. She was on the path to power when, as a 47-year-old mother of five, she ran for a seat in Congress and won. And after serving 20 years in Congress, she is now the highest-ranking elected woman in American history and the first female Speaker of the House. She is second in line to the presidency, and she shares her journey from homemaker to House Speaker, from the kitchen of her San Francisco home to the Congress of the United States in her new book, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. Our own Mayor John Hickenlooper was elected mayor of Denver in 2003, and re-elected in 2007. In April 2005, less than 2 years into his first term, Time magazine named this political newcomer one of the top five big city mayors in America. Long before he ever considered public office, Mayor Hickenlooper was active in community affairs, serving on numerous civic boards and leading a grassroots campaign to preserve Mile High Stadium, that wonderful name, back in 2000. Since taking office, Mayor Hickenlooper has increased civic engagement and participation throughout the city and Denver metro region, building strong bonds and partnerships that transcend partisan and geographic lines. Today, we welcome both Speaker Pelosi and Mayor Hickenlooper to the Tattered Cover, where the mayor will interview Speaker Pelosi about her new book, Know Your Power, A Message to America's Daughters. Welcome both.
And so I'm going to ask tough, ruthless questions about this amazing book. And I will tell you that with the convention coming on, this book would be a great gift to get some of your friends kind of wound up and excited about the democratic process. We do live in the greatest democracy on earth, and this is one of the cornerstones of our democratic process, having a convention. So this is the time to be reading books like this, because this book's got it all. Now, I've unfortunately got so many questions, so we probably won't get to all of them. I'll have to... Luckily, Speaker Pelosi is well known for being, you know, able to communicate a great deal in her answers. And so you're going to get...
Does that mean keep it short?
You know, I started to say that, and I realized that was totally inappropriate, so I tried to take off. But you read through me. Now I'm going to begin to blush.
I heard what you said.
Well... while, and I of course would go immediately being a mayor, my first question is that while your father was mayor of Baltimore, you wrote how the local families, many of them Italian, would literally line up at your house for food and help, and that ultimately your mother was the unofficial public servant. So how does this experience, you know, seeing your neighbors line up for food at your door, how does that inform your current legislative priorities about our, you know, our collective responsibility to help Americans in need?
Thank you for your question, Mr. Mayor. And before I answer it, if I may just say how honored I am to have this interview conducted by you. I was raised in the mayor's home when I was in first grade. My father became mayor, was elected mayor of Baltimore. Went away to college, he was still the mayor of Baltimore. So we had a great deal. When the mayor was in the house, that was a very important occasion. When I say in the house, I don't mean in our home. He was just dad there. But any event that he went to, so you can just imagine how thrilling it is to me to have Mayor Hickenlooper here. And I want to commend him for his extraordinary leadership, not just of Denver, but how he has taken his entrepreneurial ideas, his green print, his pioneer spirit to the Conference of Mayors and transformed that national body as well to be much more forward-thinking in its agenda. So, Mr. Mayor, thank you very much for your leadership. Thank you for being the official host of this convention, which, if I may be allowed a partisan moment, which I know will nominate the next president of the United States. I just want to say to Joyce how thrilled I am to be in the tattered cover. I told her earlier that, you know, I come here quite a bit, Diana DeGette, Mark Udall, Ed Perlmutter, Salazar, Ken and John. And on one occasion when I came for Mark Udall a few years ago, we had this lovely event for Mark's campaign. And after it was over, he said, Maggie and I would like to take you out to dinner. And I said, oh, that's really nice. Why don't you have dinner alone, and I'll go to the tattered cover? Because that's what I'd love to have dinner with you, but why don't you have a romantic dinner or go have dinner with your children? That's what you should be doing, and I can be doing what I really feel like doing. So it's a wonderful place, and I told Joyce earlier, I bought a book for my granddaughter about a little girl who struck out. She was a great baseball player, and she struck out Babe Ruth. At least that's what the story said. In any event, the world of adventure, anything the mind can imagine here at the Tattered Cover. Thank you, Joyce, for your hospitality this evening. So before, when I was born, my father was a member of Congress from Baltimore. In fact, I'm the first daughter of a congressperson to be in Congress. There have been others since then, but I was, now it was 3,000 miles away, 50 years later, with a different last name. So it wasn't like as if I was following in his footsteps. But nonetheless, I thought that was great history to be the first daughter of a former congressman. But in our home, we were taught we were devoutly Catholic, staunchly Democratic, proud of our Italian-American heritage, and deeply, deeply patriotic. It was just who we were, love America. And we had we were raised with the idea that public service was a noble calling and that we all had a responsibility to care for each other. And compassion was the order of the day, and we saw it as an extension of our faith. When the mayor talks about these people lining up in front of our door, I knew from a little girl, just having heard my mother say it so many times, I knew from a little girl how to tell somebody who to call to get housing in the projects or a bed in the city hospital or how to go on welfare or all of these things when people were in need. And what we would do if they needed a job is to try to find them a job, but then when somebody else needed a job, to have it passed on, to have those same people turn around and help someone else because now they were on their feet. So that has informed my politics for my whole life. Today I say to my colleagues all the time when we're working very hard and we're in a big fight, I say just be inspired, understand, and remember the 1 in 5 children in America who live in poverty, who go to sleep hungry at night. In America, how could it be? And then you see Katrina. How could it be? So that commitment to public service, again, the Gospel of Matthew, all of that is a part of it. Now I represent San Francisco in the Congress. My other answers will be shorter, Mr. Mayor. We're just establishing our tattered covered credentials and the rest here. Now represent the city of San Francisco in the Congress, and what a great honor that is. And the patron saint of San Francisco is St. Francis of Assisi, and his song of St. Francis, "Make Me a Channel of Thy Peace," is the anthem of our city. And he also said, "Preach the Bible. Sometimes use words." So from my upbringing and from the city I'm proud to represent, yes, my politics are very informed by both.
We know Dr. Martin Luther King as perhaps the greatest champion of civil rights in the history of this country and an orator of amazing ability, but he's also a brilliant wordsmith. And he spoke in the I Have a Dream speech of the fierce urgency of now. And from your perspective, what is the fiercest urgency of now that we face?
When Dr. King made that speech, by the way, I was at the march, but I had to go home because I was getting married the following week. And so I couldn't stay to hear the speech, but I did see the crowds and the march and the rest of it, and of course read about the speech the next day. And everybody talked about the I Had a Dream part of the speech. But what fascinated me, and I see Senator Obama references it quite a bit, is the fierce urgency of now. Now is the time to bring justice for all of America's children. And he cautioned us in that speech against dangerous luxury of gradualism, that we had to do things in a big and important visionary way. We never would have thought then, when we were all young, it was 45 years ago next week, that 45 years later we would still have to heed the call of the fierce urgency of now, because all of the challenges that Dr. King talked about have not been addressed, whether it's what I call liberty and justice for all that we pledge to every day in Congress, to the pledge to the flag, and many of you do in school and other places. But it is, it was urgent then, it's even more urgent, it's even more urgent now.
In 1984, you ran to be chair of the Democratic National Committee and lost. Instead of wallowing in defeat, you write in the book about an important lesson: organize, don't agonize.
I thank you for that, Mr. Mayor. This is one of my messages to young women and to men, too. When you have a setback, organize, don't agonize. Just move right on with it. My daughter Christine is here with me now, who is now a member of Democratic National Committee. I'm delegate to the convention, and I'm so excited that she's here. But that's one of the lessons I taught my daughter. Just pick yourself up, get ready, learn from what happened, and move on. Because that sense of organization and getting on with it, that survival tactic, will serve you very well. It certainly did me. If I had not lost for that position I was running for, I would have never won for mayor, because the lessons learned and the sense of organization that sprang, for Congress. I'm thinking of the mayor here, for Congress, would have never won for Congress. All of those lessons were very, very important to me.
She is remarkably concise.
I would have said more, but I was remembering his admonition.
No. I'm going to get myself in trouble. Yeah, I should keep my mouth shut. Part of your political inspiration came from Sally Burton, who held your congressional seat and encouraged you to run as she battled cancer in 1987. Your youngest daughter, Alexandra, was still in high school, and you worried that the campaign would disrupt her life unfairly. Instead, she told you, "Mother, get a life." And so you ran for office. The question I have is, how do you like this life you went out and got?
Can you imagine? I was thinking, I had five children, and four of them were already in college. These children were born almost to the day, 6 years apart, the five of them. So four of them were already away, and she was going to be a senior in high school, and I go from the deepest part of my heart, with all the sincerity I can mess, it doesn't matter one decision or another, I can run or not run. Mother, get a life. What teenager would not want her mother out of town for three nights a week? But it is, and so I did. I don't think that, she also said, Mr. Mayor, speaking of pioneers, she also said to me after I was in Congress for a few years, she said, Mother, I'm very, very proud of you. I said, because I'm a woman member of Congress? She said, no, because you're a pioneer. Pioneer. I said, well, in what respect? And she said, well, remember when you used to cook and then you stopped? Well, now hardly anybody cooks, but you were one of the first people to stop. Well, I thought, you know, 20 years of three square meals on the day for five kids and all their friends, I had earned the right to a little carry out here and there. But that in any event, it is, and this is really, I didn't have any intention of running for Congress or anything, public office. I had been the chair of the California Democratic Party. I was a behind-the-scenes person, and I encouraged other people to do that, but I never had any intention of doing it myself. Well, I had all these children. When they were in school all day, I got more involved in the Democratic Party, and then this happened just as four of them were away at college and one almost. And so that's, again, one of the lessons. You have... Be fair to yourself as you take stock. Can I do this? Am I ready for this? And I say to moms who've raised a family, nothing prepared me more for being a member of Congress and now the Speaker of the House than raising a family with all the organization and discipline and diplomacy, interpersonal skills, cooking, driving, the rest of it, multitasking and all, never for one moment taking your eye off the kids. You know, it's a formidable credential. Sometimes moms will say to me, well, I was out of it for 10 or 12 years raising my family, so I've only been back in the workforce. I said, no, you were in growing our country, raising the next generation. Value that credential. It's very important. And we need it. We need women. I encourage young women especially to run. Well, when I say young, I mean young or new coming out of when I ran, I was 47. They said, late in life, she ran for Congress. And I was like, late in life? I don't know. Now it seems like very young to me 21 years later. But the thing is this, that who better for young working moms to see having a voice at the place of power than people who are sharing their experience, raising young children, understanding the aspirations, challenges, hopes, and dreams of young families, and to see someone who looks like them have that power is, I think, very encouraging to them and will encourage them also to be involved. If I may, Mr. Mayor, I'd just like to tell a little story about that. When I was first elected a leader in the Congress, I wasn't speaker yet, but I was the leader of the Democrats. I went to, was invited to my first meeting with the leadership in the White House. And I had been to many meetings at the White House as in my committee assignments and the rest. So I wasn't apprehensive about the meeting at all. I mean, it was on my schedule. So I went to the White House, the door closed behind me, and there was President Bush, gracious, Vice President, and the other the Republican House and Senate leadership, and not a very, you know, eight people probably. And then I realized immediately that this was unlike any meeting, the other meeting I had been at the White House. Because here I was seated at the table. In fact, it was unlike any meeting that any woman had been at the White House. Seated at the table, my place there by dint of my being the leader of the House Democrats. Not by appointment by the president, so that his opinion was the opinion that I shared, but representing the beautifully diverse Democratic caucus in the Congress. And as the president was making his opening remarks, all of a sudden, in my chair, I swear this happened, Mr. Mayor, I was crowded. I was crowded in. It was packed and jammed on my seat. I could just feel it. I was being squeezed in like this, and I was sort of paying attention to what the president was saying, but I realized probably more then than now, but I had all these people say, and I realized that it was Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Alice Paul and Lucretia Mott and women who had worked forever for over 150 years so that women could vote women could attain power. And here we were sitting there, all of us on that chair, and the president's going on, and I could hear them say, at last we have a seat at the table. I could hear them say that. And then they were gone. And my first thought was, we want more. We want more women. We want more minorities. We want more diversity at that table. I never had such an experience before or since. But I do know every day that I'm standing on the shoulders of great, very courageous women, and that I have a responsibility to the next generation. And that's why I wrote this book, to say this is how I went from the kitchen to the Congress. This is how I want you to value your experience. This is how I went from homemaker to House Speaker. You are so needed to women of all ages. And again, nothing more wholesome for our system than the increased participation of women.
That's a tough one to follow. Although I do think it's worth illuminating. I'll take this question out of order. That when she said she had the 5 children 6 years apart, what she meant was that she had 5 children in 6 years. Right. So just, let's just be perfectly clear. I hope you all understood that. So she did that, and when she was asked how she managed to do all that and go to Congress, she said, of course, I did it sequentially. So,
but that's it.
It's a good line. So I think that, and this question follows right on what you were describing. Despite the significant barriers broken by your ascension to become Speaker of the House and by Hillary Clinton's amazing primary run, what challenges still face women today in terms of raising a family and advancing their careers?
Well, I'm completely in awe of the young women today who are doing this concurrently. You know, it was one thing for me to be home with my 5 kids and raise a family, and some days I didn't even wash my face. I mean, I kept meaning to, and then... But, you know, when I brought my baby, Alexandra, our youngest, home from the hospital, that week our oldest child was turning 6. So they were very close. So when I see young women today who are working and raising a family and keeping all these balls in the air, and some of them single moms, I am totally in awe of them, because that makes raising any number of children when you're at home look a lot easier than having to take that other responsibility. So it's interesting to me that so many young women still say to me that their challenges, of course, that challenge of multitasking and raising a family and working, but also there's still challenges in the workplace where their contribution is not fully appreciated. And I think we just have to put that aside. The mayor referenced Hillary Clinton's incredible, fabulous candidacy for president of the United States, and she made us all very, very proud with her intellect, her eloquence, her stamina, her political savvy, and the rest. And again, I take great pride in being the first woman Speaker of the House. But it's not just about us. It's about all of the women that we are opening the doors for, and so that their views will be respected when they walk through those doors. And one of the things I tell in the book about this is the secret sauce. I went to Congress 21 years ago. Joyce mentioned that. And when you got there, and there were only 20 women there. There were only 20 women 21 years ago. Now we have like 80. It's still not enough, but it's been my determination to keep increasing that number. So when I got there, the old boy network, the old bulls, they had sort of an attitude that if you needed something done, just let us know. We'll take care of it for you. They didn't say this, but this is what I heard. We have the secret sauce. You could never possibly understand the recipe for it, but we know how to get things done. Tap, tap, tap on the top of your head. And, of course, that was their way of controlling everything well into the future, but they had been controlling well into the past. And they made terrific contributions to our country. I don't mean to minimize all the great work that has been done by the male leadership of our country. However, I think diversity, another view, is healthy. And so we decided to pull back that veil, hiding the secret sauce to show that there really isn't any secret sauce, and that we could probably cook up something, not to carry the analogy too far. But so reluctant were they to ask our opinion about something. Listen, so reluctant were they to ask our opinion about something that I think nothing tells the story better than this one evening. We're all out to dinner. We had a group. My colleague Barbara Boxer, she represented Marin County, and she was in the House at that time. It's my dear friend, and Barbara Cannelli, who was a congresswoman from Connecticut. So we used to go out to dinner with some of our male colleagues on Tuesday night club, and they would talk about all issues, never once ever thinking, "What do you think?" Just bum, talk among themselves about these things. And if you wanted to get a word in, you had to jump in, but you never expected anybody to say, "What do you think, Nancy?" So one night, guess what they're talking about? Childbirth. Childbirth. So they're going on and on about childbirth. Now, Barbara has two, Barbara Boxer two, Barbara Cannelli four, I have five. We had 11 children among the three of us, so we thought, for surely this night they will turn to us and say, "Does this make you uncomfortable or whatever?" And so they go on and are saying, "Oh, when I had my first, our labor, it was long." "Your labor was long?" "Our labor, it was long. And I had on my green gown and the hat and the thing over my mouth. And I couldn't go with the first child, but the second time the doctor let me in, I got in that room and said, 'I'm getting out of here.'" And then the next one was there. I went in. Oh, my gosh. I had the camera. I took all the pictures. "I'll show you the pictures if you know. We don't want to see the pictures." And we just went on and on about how long their labors were and how hard it was. And still, we're like hitting each other with elbows. And for surely, nothing. 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 It didn't even occur to them that we might, A, have an opinion, or frankly, not want to hear about it. So about a week later, we're at dinner with another member of Congress and this same group, but another person who wasn't there, Don Edwards is his name, and he was the floor leader of the Equal Rights Amendment. He was a California member. He's no longer in Congress, but still with us. In any event, he said to me, we're talking about something, and he said, "Nancy, what do you think?" But I was so shocked. And he said, "Why are you reacting that way?" And I told him the story. Well, these same men who were at the table the week before and now this night said, "That could not possibly have happened. We would never have done that." They didn't even know. They didn't have a clue that they didn't have a clue about how they were. But anyway, I think it did make some adjustments for them so that now I always want to hear the opinions of my colleagues on every subject. But when it comes to childbirth, I think I have that covered.
And also often I think that is the difference between prejudice and ignorance. Right? I mean, they weren't really prejudiced. They were just ignorant.
They
had a bias.
Good intention. Without... Oh, they were so sweet. But, you know, so we knew not to ever wait around for them to ask our opinion.
So that leads me to another question, and you describe in the book about being confused with Barbara Boxer. And once the security guards figured out that you were a member of Congress, you said, "I can go anywhere I want," except apparently for the men's bathroom. So perhaps you would tell that story. What prompted you to walk into the men's room?
Well, I didn't actually, but what happened was when I was first elected, just a few days after my election, I went into a stationery store to buy some thank you notes to write to people, handwrite. And while I was in there, you know how you're in a shop, Joyce will know this, where you're not sure you're going to buy something, so you're sort of low key, sort of just kind of looking. And the woman from behind the counter, she said, "I know who you are." I thought, "Oh wow, I'm just elected Tuesday, this is Saturday. She knows who I am. I'm now going to be the congresswoman." So I said, "Yes." And she said, "You're Barbara Boxer." And I said, No, I'm not. Here I was a little, not deflated. I love Barbara. She's wonderful. And yes, you are. I said, well, no, I'm not. So then I finally said, no, I'm Nancy Pelosi. To which she says, are you sure? Are you sure? Yeah, I'm sure. But anyway, subsequent to that, when I got to Washington, I came in a special election because, as was mentioned, Congresswoman Sala Burton, our congresswoman, died, and she asked me to run in her place before she died. And that's a whole other story that's in the book. But when I got there, when you go with a class, you know, like the class that we will elect in November, they all memorize, they have photographs, they memorize the faces, they know this one, she's from there, and he's from there, and this, that. When you go in a special election, they just toss you in the water. Nobody knows who you are, and you're as junior as you can be, so nobody even cares who you are. So every place I would go, they'd say, I'm sorry, you can't go there. You can't go there. That's for congresswoman. You can't go there. I said, no, I'm a congresswoman. Who are you from? Look it up in the book. Call on the phone, this or that. So one day, finally, I went to this place, and I said to the guard, I'm a member of Congress. I'm Nancy Pelosi. He said, well, if you're a member of Congress, you can go anywhere, any place you want. So later that day, I was on the floor of the House, and I was trying to get a vote from one of my members. So I followed him out the door of the chamber into what is called the Speaker's Lobby. And then he went into the store with this beautiful mahogany panel. And, you know, it was a beautiful, beautiful entrance. So I started to go in there, and the guard said, you can't go there. I said, I can go any place I want. I'm a member of Congress. He said, Congresswoman, it's the men's room.
That's the story. It's a good story.
It's still a lot bigger and better. I mean, by all outside appearances, I would not.
Bigger.
Than our little ladies' room.
Now that I've led the speaker on to the smutty side of the conversation, we'll go to
potty talk.
We'll go to some questions from the audience, which Charles pulled together for me. What recommendations would you have for young people interested in getting into politics?
You see before you an example of someone who made his success in the private sector, brought that entrepreneurial spirit into the public arena, which has benefited us all. They're all different routes to take. And depending on how interested you are in being a public servant yourself, or just helping others, or supporting a cause, there is plenty of opportunity to be involved. My own route was, of course, I was imbued with a public spirit from an early age, but that had nothing to do with it inspired me, but it didn't give me a channel. I was 3,000 miles away. So we sort of just volunteered in the Democratic Party or for candidates or organized for causes, getting signatures, just at the very basic grassroots level. But as I say in the book, if you can be relied upon to do something finite, don't overpromise. This is what I can do. You can be relied upon to do that, then other opportunities will be open to you. And I think that we had an extraordinary primary. We had great candidates. It came down to two fantastic candidates, and people were attracted. And the presidential is when people are attracted to politics. But many people like to be involved on a more local level because their impact is great. You know the people. You'll be able to help them after they're elected in a very direct way. So my advice has always been, do what you're doing. I say in there, age quod agis, it's Latin. Do what you're doing. What did they ask you to do? What did you say you would do? Get that done. Go on to the next step, and one thing will lead to another. My volunteerism for the San Francisco Library led me to become a member of the commission, which led me then to be involved civically in an official way in our city, and then on to work in the Democratic Party and the rest. But those steps are necessary, and it's hard work involved. It really is hard work. So don't bite off more than you can chew. Just do what you can honorably do responsibly, because you have responsibilities to your family, to your job, to other aspects of your life. But I tell you, if you can be relied upon, you will be relied upon, and you will reap a reward. And then you have to decide for yourself how much of a public role you want to play. And be very fair to yourself. Be overly fair to yourself about what you have to offer, never forgetting you're the only person who can make your contribution. It's very unique. Nothing in this book is mysterious or new to you. Just confirms what you already know.
I should ask you this, because you do talk in the book, and a little bit, you should mention something about your trip to China and some of your
statements. Well, in the time of the Olympics now, isn't it something? Aren't we proud? By the way, Michael Phelps is from Baltimore, Maryland.
How many home cities could you really claim?
Well, you know what they did the night of he got the eighth gold medal. They had a Ravens football game that night, and so everybody stayed in the stadium, had the big screens, and they showed the relay and then the gold medal ceremony. The city went wild. When I first went to Congress, I had the opportunity to meet with His Holiness the Dalai Lama almost immediately, within a matter of months. My colleague Tom Lantos, who died earlier this year, but he was the chair of the Human Rights Caucus. In any event, I became involved with the issue. My district is very interested in it. I can boast of the biggest, I think, Chinatown in America, where many of our people were concerned about human rights in China. At the time of the Tiananmen Square massacre, everyone was of one voice on it. Now people have different views on the approaches we could take. But at that time, they turned out by the thousands, year in and year out, about it. So a couple of years into that, maybe 91, I think it was, I went on a human rights trip to China, and we try to be saying, well, how can we work together? What will really work to bring freedom? And we were trying to free the prisoners who were arrested at the time of Tiananmen Square. So anyway, one thing led to another. We were at Tiananmen Square, and we unfurled a banner honoring those who gave their lives for democracy. And as soon as that banner was unfurled, oh my gosh, security forces, I don't know whether they were police or army or whatever, security forces just descended on us, chased us out. Some of the press was following us. They got hit and banged. Some of my colleagues did, too. I was running very fast in front of the pack. But anyway, it was, not to go into too much detail about it, except that it was very interesting to me, because when that next election, we worked very hard to make this an issue, human rights. Because if you ignore human rights in a place like China because it's big and it's a commercial issue, in my view, you lose all moral authority to talk about it in other places in the world that might be smaller economies and smaller countries. And so it's been a big issue for me. And I had the privilege of going in March to visit His Holiness the Dalai Lama in Dar es Salaam in India. And it was longstanding. We planned the trip in December. But by the time we got there, they had just had the uprisings in the brutal repression of the demonstrations in Tibet. So again, this issue still goes on, and nothing really much has changed in terms of human rights in China, even though people said, if you just let it take its natural course, it will. But I do think that this is a pillar of our foreign policy. What are the pillars of our foreign policy? Our national security, stopping proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, building our own economy through trade with other countries, fighting terrorism for sure, having a military second to none, and again, promoting democratic freedoms. That doesn't mean invading other countries to inflict our will on those countries. Yesterday I spoke to most recently with the ambassador from Georgia. Tomorrow or the next day I'll be sending some members of Congress to Georgia to see how we can be helpful to resolve this in a diplomatic way to stop the violence there.
What piece of legislation are you most proud of passing or helping push through Congress? Why?
When I became Speaker, my flagship issue was the issue of energy security and global warming. I called the House to order, and it's pictures on the book, in honor of all of America's children. And I believe that our responsibility to those children is to have a secure country, and energy independence is a national security issue. It's an economic issue for the pocketbooks of individual American families, but also for our economy. It's a health issue, an environmental health issue in terms of emissions and fossil fuels and the rest. And it is a moral issue. Well, that's why we work with the evangelical community as well as the scientists and the business and labor and environmentalist to preserve, as the evangelicals say, God's garden, and to do so in a way that is not harmful to poor people, because we're having to take some steps to do that. And the so when I became speaker, I established a select committee on energy security and global warming. It had met with resistance because we were changing. We were making change. We were being disruptive. And the but we were able to put together an energy bill that, for the first time in 32 years, reduced the emissions, raised the standards per gallon of miles per gallon, which again was helpful to the environment, and many things on efficiencies and conservation, which were the equivalent of taking every car off the road in America for 1 year. So, but it isn't finished. We have much more to do, but that's all that we could get passed and signed by the president. We're ready with much more in that regard. But nobody, everybody said you'll never get it passed because the status quo people in Washington, the special interest people won't let it happen. But the American people are way ahead of us, and indeed the mayors are way ahead of us. When I became speaker, the mayors came to see me with their 10 principles for stronger families, stronger cities, stronger America. And number one on that was the climate crisis, the energy crisis issue. And that really encouraged our members to follow the lead of the mayors on this subject. So it's a neighborhood issue, it's a city issue, it's a state, it's a national, it's a global issue, and we have to work in all of those arenas to do that. One of the bills that we didn't get passed that we will, as soon as we have a new president, was our children's health insurance, the state children's health insurance, the SCHIP bill. This is a bill that we've passed over and over again, but the president won't sign it. He says we can't afford it. Now, both on the energy bill and on the SCHIP bill, we had strong bipartisan support, Democrats and Republicans alike, supporting both of these bills. President ended up signing the energy bill, but not with everything we wanted, but he didn't sign the children's bill. And I said, this bill would have insured 10 million more children in America. 10 million more eligible children in America. The president said, we can't afford it. Think of this. 40 days in Iraq. 10 million children in America insured for 1 year. For what it cost for 40 days in Iraq. So, you know, this war has to come to an end for many reasons, and the opportunity cost for the health of our children is one of them. But we will pass it again, and with a new president, we will get it signed come January.
As a former geologist, I want to make perfectly clear, as a former geologist and a present mayor, I can say that we have never had someone in the House who understands energy better than Speaker Pelosi. And as mayors, we are very grateful for that.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Now, this is an interesting question from the crowd. In politics, womanhood is generally equated with weakness. How do you go into a male-dominated field and not only refuse to deny your womanhood, but use it as a strength?
I think that we have to be disruptive about this. This is, being a woman is a giant strength in politics, because women want to see women succeed. Fathers of daughters want to see women succeed. Many men want to see women succeed. And I don't see it. I really don't see it as a weakness. It's only a weakness if you present it as such. But I just think that you saw the response that Hillary Clinton got from women. That was a major part of her showing in this election. Women are viewed to be concerned about issues that relate to family and home and health care and the rest and education. But women can be champions on national security and the economy of our country and our energy independence. So while we have original responsibility for some of these, shall we say, issues, two bills we passed right before we left the Congress, for example, would not have happened without the women in Congress. Pay equity, finally passed by the Congress under a Democratic majority. For years, we tried to bring it up, but until we had the gavel, we couldn't even bring it to the floor. Pay equity. Now the work of women in the workforce will be valued the same as men. And it's a very sound, reasonable bill. We also passed that same week the Consumer Product Safety Bill. Toys and other products used by children. This bill was sent to the president and has been signed by the president already. It was on Friday. Women fought so hard, not just to get a bill, but to have the best possible bill to protect our children. And sometimes it would never have happened without women there. But that isn't to say we should be confined to those issues. The protection of our country, the strength of our economy, all of these issues, they're women's issues as well. And I just think, you know, we got to put aside, if you have to be disruptive, you have to put aside some of the views that people have about women in politics and will they be strong enough and the rest. And you've got to forget phrases like modesty forbids. Forget that. Just say what you believe. Demonstrate your knowledge. And these are the four things I say to people, because I had to train candidates when I was chair of the party, and then I had to train myself, which was the hardest of all. But what is your vision? There you are as a woman. You're going, what is your vision about whatever the issue is, or for your city or state or whatever? What is the knowledge that you have? Know your stuff. Know the budget. Know your stuff. Impress people with your knowledge. Have a plan on how you're going to get a certain job done. And when you show that knowledge and planning and a goal, a vision, people will be attracted to you. They'll be attracted. They will support you. They will support your cause. They will support your candidacy if that is what it is. But forget forever that being a woman is a weakness in politics. I don't think that it is. My colleagues elected me to be the Speaker of the House. President, Vice President, Speaker of the House. I'm proud of them for doing that. The last thing I could have ever said to them is, will you vote for me because I'm a woman and I think we should have a woman as Speaker? That would have been, forget about it. I just had to show that I was strong and knowledgeable and the rest, so that I could win their trust and confidence. And I think that they're proud of the fact that they have honored the tradition of America, our heritage and our hope, which is equality of all people.
Beautiful.
This is an appropriate question. How do you respond to the protesters? This card says outside. It was written before the book we began. Who are critical of your energy plan, say you are an agent of big wind, and criticize your decisions. Me either. That's why I thought it was a funny question. A big wind, and criticize your decisions against offshore drilling.
Well, thank you for that question. Here's the thing. Those who will say to you that if we drill offshore, we will bring down the price at the pump now, are foisting a hoax on the American people. It simply is not true. It probably take 10 years to have an impact of 2 cents on the price at the pump if you drill offshore. Now, when I became Speaker, I became fairly agnostic about different approaches to problems. I have my values, I have my preferences, but I have to listen to everyone and see what the best of their ideas are. So I say to these people, if you want to drill in the Outer Continental Shelf, there are certain things I think you should consider. First of all, there are 68 million acres that you can drill on right now in the lower 48, as we refer to the lower 48. Maybe 10 to 15 million to 20 million more acres in Alaska, the National Petroleum Reserve, Alaska. not the Arctic Refuge, but the National Petroleum Reserve, not ANWR, but where the permits are allowed. So you're asking to drill someplace where you don't have a permit that's going to take time to get, it's going to save 2 cents 10 years from now, when you can be drilling where you have permits right now, use it or lose it. Let somebody else drill there. The biggest way to have an impact at the pump right now is to release oil from the SPRO, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. The three previous presidents have, well, two previous and the current one, President Bush, 41, President Clinton, and President Bush, 43, released oil from the SPRO, and it has brought down the price of oil. And so we're saying to President Bush, do that now. Don't try to say, but if we could only drill in a protected offshore, then we could bring down the price at the pump. You know it isn't true, but you can bring it down now. So release oil from the SPRO, use it or lose it, and undo speculation. Some speculation is healthy. Some is exploitive. Let's know the difference in terms of the commodities market. And gas. Gas, natural gas, the discoveries in natural gas have made it plentiful, cheap, and much cleaner than oil. So this is transformational. It's a game changer. And invest in the renewable energy resources. Yes, wind, solar, biofuels, and the list goes on. That will bring a bigger return sooner that is better for the environment, better for the economy, preserves God's creation. Now, what I say to them when they're offshore, okay, you want to put it on the table? Let's put it on the table. When we put it on the table, let's rethink and renegotiate the relationship to this oil, which belongs to the American people, and the profits that big oil is reaping from them. This oil belongs to the American people. If you want to drill there, we want the royalties, which they are not paying, some of those profits, to go to the U.S. taxpayer. Use that taxpayer to invest in renewable energy resources, and we are solving our problem. Also, don't expect us to subsidize it. Imagine, this oil belongs to us. Big oil wants to drill there. They're saying to us, you have to pay for our drilling there because our profits are not big enough. Record profit, so we want you to subsidize it. So I'm saying, you want to drill there? Let's talk about the safeguards. Let's talk about the subsidies that you shouldn't have. Let's talk about the royalties that the American people deserve, because this oil belongs to them. And they might be able to come up with something that we can do. But don't expect us not to fight you on this cruel hoax, which is, if we could drill there, the price will come down now at the pump. But we have to consider all of it, and that's what we will do.
All right, this is going to be the last question, and then we'll, I think the speaker will come down and do a little serious autographing for all you book hounds. All those books you're buying for gifts, remember the beginning?
What a salesman, the private sector, the entrepreneur.
And this is an interesting question. There are a lot of questions on energy. I think we've covered it pretty well. There are a couple questions in here. People wanted to get tickets to hear Senator Obama speak. I'm afraid that they're in the wrong place.
Call the mayor.
Yeah, right. Yeah, call the mayor. Everyone else has. The U.S. AID budget is approximately 0.5% of the federal appropriations. There is significant progress between Arabs, Israelis, Jordanians in cooperating with research projects, especially concerning medicine and agriculture. They have become good friends. How can we get our government to further fund and support these endeavors and peaceful cooperation?
I want to take this back to when I was young, even younger than at Martin Luther King's speech that I didn't hear. This was 1961. I was a student in Washington, D.C. Oh, by the way, I was with my parents in Los Angeles when President Kennedy spoke at the L.A. Coliseum. So when presidential nominee Barack Obama announced that he was going to speak at the stadium, I was so thrilled, because that is going to be very, very exciting, and the mayor's promised that the weather's going to be perfect. But in 1961, just a few months after that speech.
She doesn't know that I don't have a very good record with the weather. The snowstorms.
Just a few months afterward, on the steps of the Capitol, President Kennedy made his inaugural address. And you all know, again, we talked earlier about Martin Luther King, the I Had a Dream part of the speech. Not as many people know about the fierce urgency in that part of the speech. They're beginning to know more. But in the President Kennedy's inaugural address, he said to the citizens of America, ask not what America can do for you, but what you can do for your country, what our country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. You've all read about that in the history books, right? It's history to you. It was my youth. Maybe somebody else in the room remembers that he said that. I mean, I know you know he said it, but remembers when hearing him say that. But the next sentence, the very next sentence in the speech, President Kennedy said, to the citizens of the world, ask not what America can do for you, but what we can do working together for the freedom of mankind. And this question about how we can work together, health issues, peace, and all the rest, that's what this is about. It's about America taking its rightful place in the world, not in a condescending, disrespectful way, but what we can do working together, respectfully working together for the freedom of mankind, listening to other countries about how this can work, and to do it in a way that gets a result to alleviate poverty, to eradicate disease, to stop terrorism, eradicate the violence that feeds the fury of despair contributes to that. And so we should be doing much more in our allocation of resources, certainly, to help on these issues. Because these health issues know no boundaries. HIV, you name it, malaria, tuberculosis, they know no boundaries. And the fact that the Gates Foundation spends more on those issues than the federal government is just an incredible thing. We did pass a bill that I'm very proud of about 2 weeks ago, maybe three now, in the Congress that increases the money we will spend on malaria, tuberculosis, and HIV/AIDS. Again, not funded, because you know people are for the issue, but when it comes time to fund it, it's sometimes a different story. And we have insisted that all of these initiatives, whether they relate to energy or our international responsibilities or whatever they are, be paid for. Because we cannot build the future we want for our kids and our grandchildren and for our country if we are heaping mountains of debt. So we're saying no new deficit spending, pay as you go. But what it means is a realignment of priorities about what is important, and that's what our budget should reflect. So I'm optimistic that when we go from here, our way of approaching the world will be more collaborative and cooperative and respectful. Philosopher Hannah Arendt, she once wrote that some nations are on a constant flywheel of violence. They think if just one more act of violence is going to end it. But it doesn't. It just contributes to more of it. President Kennedy said when he was president, one of the last speeches he made on the subject, America will never start a war. Never start a war. Of course, we will defend us, you know, pay any price, fight any foe, bear any burden, certainly to protect our country, but that we wouldn't start a war. And here we have done that. It's a tremendous loss to of life, of course, and limb, thousands injured, many permanently, hundreds of thousands seeking mental health counseling, hundreds of thousands with a PTSD, loss of reputation in the world, trillions of dollars in cost, and undermining our military capability to fight anyone who threatens our interest anywhere in the world. So this war has had a big, big price. It's not made us safer. It has not brought stability to the region. It must end. Just think if we had been spending that money to make the world a better place in terms of alleviation of poverty and eradication of disease, how much better off we could be than the road that was taken. But we have a chance for a different road. If I just may thank all of you so much for coming, and just to say what a thrill it is always to be in Denver and to be in Colorado. I know that some of you don't want any Californians coming. I'm not staying. I'm just visiting and enjoying it. But it this pioneer spirit, and I'll talk about it at the convention. When you see America the Beautiful written on Pike's Peak, Catherine Lee Bates writing that here, right in her hotel room in Denver after visiting Pike's Peak. My favorite is the fourth verse, and it reminds me of what the challenges that we have now. It said, "Oh, beautiful for patriot dream that sees beyond the years, that sees beyond the years." That's what we have an opportunity, if I may say, and the choice that we have coming up soon. Seeing beyond the years, true to the patriot dream of our country, and having a dream, having a knowledge, having a plan, attracting the followers, the supporters in a very bipartisan way to take our country in a new direction. That is in keeping with our founders and all the vision that they had, honoring the sacrifice of our troops and just thrilled with joy about the aspiration of our children. So thank you for turning out tonight. I love seeing all of you. And thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Ladies and gentlemen, the incomparable Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi.
Let's thank Mayor Hickenlooper for his wonderful performance.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for William Dewey and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on August 20th, 2008.